The U.S. Senate is about to set a record-breaking number of filibusters this term, slowing down the operation of what was already known somewhat derisively as the world's most deliberative legislative body. Joining us now to help us analyze this trend is Sarah Binder, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a political science professor at George Washington University. Welcome to our show today for our second backstory segment.
Excellent. Thank you for having me.
As I understand it, the Senate is the only legislative body in the world that has a filibuster. Has the tactic been a part of Senate procedures since the days of the Founding Fathers?
Well, that is probably the most common myth about the Senate and the filibuster, right? That the framers designed this chamber to be this grand deliberative body with no limits on debate. It turns out that, as best we can tell, the filibuster is actually a mistake, that it was a historical accident from a very accidental change in the rules back in 1806.
And it happened only in the Senate? We don't have filibusters in the House, do we?
Well, this is the sort of odd part. In 1789, when the new House and Senate met for the very first time, they each had to draw up a set of rules. And both the House and the Senate actually had very nearly identical sets of rules. And in fact, both chambers had this one rule that today the House uses to cut off debate. So that today they have this strict majority cloture rule, so there will be no filibusters. The Senate, in 1806, there turns out they're looking at the rule book. The vice president, this is Aaron Burr, who's just freshly shot off and killed Alexander Hamilton. He's presiding over the Senate, and he gives them advice about their rule book. And he says, look, you have all these rules. They do different things. We don't know how to use them. We rarely use them. And this one rule he singles out that the House uses today to cut off debate, he singles out that rule, and he says, you don't need this. And so in 1806, they cleaned their rule book, and they got rid of the one rule that would have allowed them to cut off filibusters.
Another reason to be angry with Aaron Burr.
Yet another one.
But you could argue that the filibuster is at least in some ways a fortunate accident for the party that's in the minority at any particular time.
Well, absolutely. Minority parties, members of the minority, have historically, at least from the 1830s, once they've figured out what they could do under Senate rules, minority party members have exploited it to pursue policy change they want and to block policy change that they really don't want. And, of course, members of the majority party use the rule as well, right? Oftentimes because they disagree with the majority party or they find closer agreement with the minority. Or sometimes simply because to stand up for their states, they use it.
Where does the word filibuster come from?
It's got a sort of twisted lineage. First, we think from the Dutch, who had a term, two terms called freebooters. Essentially, these were terms that eventually were applied to pirates, sort of people who would go out on the sea and steal booty from ships. Eventually, that word gets used by the English, it gets used by the French, and eventually the Spanish, who turned it into the word filibusteros. And eventually then the Americans take it from filibusteros who were marauding across Central America, and then they use it by the 1850s in the United States.
And it gets used in a lot at certain times and hardly ever at others. During the lifetime many people who listened to this show, it was used a lot by Southern Democrats when civil rights began to be debated in Congress. But then in the 1969-1970 session of Congress, the filibuster wasn't used even once.
Well, there's definitely been variation in senators' willingness to filibuster. And certainly over the course of the 20th century, in the last couple of decades, we've seen this sort of exponential increase. But it's really those civil rights filibusters at mid-century that really were quite consequential, in part because conservative Republicans and conservative Democrats were using it to block civil rights. And liberal Democrats and liberal Republicans we used to have together essentially agreed that they themselves couldn't use the filibuster because they had attacked it so hard when Southern conservatives were using it. And we all think that probably helped restrain the use of filibusters for most of that mid-century period, other than or beyond civil rights measures.
Well, many people think of the filibuster as it was portrayed by Jimmy Stewart's character in Frank Capra's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. In your opinion, does the Hollywood treatment of the tactic sync up with the reality?
Well, I think it probably once met the reality, or one of the realities of how filibusters were used, right? We have tales from the 1830s, 1840s, where senators in their memoirs would keep track and sort of give blow-by-blow descriptions of what was going on in the cloakrooms while other senators were out on the floor. They talk about the food being served and how they're going to sustain the senators on the floor. But the 1830s were a really long time ago, and in fact, we rarely ever see any type of sort of pull-out-the-cots all-night filibuster, unless it's really been sort of staged to make a point by the majority party.
Well, the rules allow for unlimited debate. A filibuster isn't a debate, especially when you get senators reading favorite recipes and reciting Shakespeare.
That's a good point. If you pull out that rule book for the Senate, what the Senate actually makes reference to is debatable motions versus non-debatable motions. And it's those debatable motions that give rise to the concept of extended debate into filibusters. But there's no requirement that you stick to the topic at hand. And in part because not only does the Senate allow extended debate, it doesn't have what they have in the House, which is called a germaneness rule. In other words, senators really can talk about anything they want because there's no rule that the presiding officer can sort of call them on it and say, look, you're not talking about anything germane. Well, there is no germaneness rule under most situations in the Senate, and that gives rise to the reading of the oyster recipes and the reading of the telephone book and all the other sort of lore we have about the Senate.
How much is the filibuster just theatrics then?
Well, there's less and less of the theatrics today, largely because the threat of the filibuster is often enough to get the majority leader to back off any big issue that he might have wanted or she might have wanted to put onto the floor. Right? In a period of, say, the 1920s or 1930s, where the Senate might not be doing all that much because the federal government might not be doing that much, it was much easier to wait out the filibustering senators. And so there might have been a lot of theatrics while the majority waited out and tried to wear down the minority. But in today's Senate, the agenda is so crowded, right? There's so much on the legislative agenda, both for senators' individual agendas, for the majority party's agenda, for the president's agenda, that leaders don't have that luxury, right? They don't have the luxury of trying to have this war of intensity against the minority. They just would much rather pull the bill from the floor, put it aside, and move on to something else where they know they can get consent to proceed.
My guest is Sarah Binder, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and political science professor at George Washington University. But we, as I said earlier, in 69-70, the filibuster wasn't used even once. 2001, Democrats used it 34 times or threatened to use it. Last term, Republicans filibustered 61 times. So what's happening here?
Well, there are a few forces here to keep in mind that have changed since the 1960s, right, since that Congress where we have absolutely no votes on cloture. One thing that has happened, and I think this is a pretty key issue, one is simply what we call sort of the ideological polarization of the two political parties. That is, Democrats as a group, as a party, have become more and more like each other. They share much more tightly on their policy views. They're much less diverse than they were in the 1960s. Right. They're much more liberal, in fact. Right. We don't really have conservative Democrats left in the Senate today. And the same thing has happened on the Republican side of the aisle, which is that right, we can count the number of Republican moderates on one hand. Right. The two senators from Maine, Collins and Snow. We used to count Senator Specter till he crossed the aisle to join the Democrats. Right. There are so few moderates that party has become very conservative. And once you disagree in policy terms, right, it's much harder to reach the threshold you need to cut off debate under the filibuster. So that's one big problem for the Senate, is that on policy terms, the parties are quite on sort of singing from different pages. The related problem that helps explain why there's so many filibusters and so many cloture votes today compared to the 60s is, as the parties have polarized, they've also become more partisan, per se. There's a lot more sort of what we might think of as partisan team play, that Republicans are expected to vote with their leader on procedural votes, just as Democrats are expected to vote with their leader on procedural votes. And if the parties stick together, right, if partisans stick together on these procedural votes, that brings the Senate to a stalemate, and that encourages the leader to file more and more cloture votes to try to break these threats to filibuster.
And right now we have this 59-41 split, which means that there's the threat of filibuster on pretty much every bill.
Absolutely, although I think even in the last Congress where the Democratic majority wasn't quite as large, we still had historic levels of votes on cloture to cut off filibusters or threaten filibusters. And so I don't know that it's so much how many Democrats there are, but it's probably more likely it's the issues that they're being called to vote on, as well as this intense partisanship and polarization.
Well, we have a situation where something like 300 bills were passed by the House that the Senate won't even consider for debate. Direct result of this?
That is much of the problem, right? Much of the problem is that in the Senate, where they don't have there's no majority vote to call up a bill, right? Even the motion to proceed to a bill can be filibustered. And in that sense, if you don't have 60 votes, the leader doesn't have 60 votes, oftentimes he doesn't even call up the bill on the floor. And keep in mind that some of the big major bills this year have consumed inordinate amounts of floor time in the Senate. Healthcare reform, 4 weeks. Financial services reform, 4 weeks, compared to how long it takes the House, right? The House can dispense of a landmark, major bill, one day, maybe a day and a half at most. But the Senate doesn't have that. They don't have the tools or the rules that allow them to march through their agenda. And almost by definition, then, we see bills piling up after they come out of the House and wait attention in the Senate.
And you don't always have to filibuster. Many Democrats may be asking themselves, why doesn't Senator Harry Reid let a Republican talk for 12 hours to try and block a climate change bill? I mean, why did that sort of thing happen? Why didn't they just call up the bill and let the Republicans talk for a while?
Well, that's a great question, and it comes up repeatedly when observers of the Senate talk about reform. And some people say, well, we don't need to change the rules. We just need to enforce the ones that are there. Let's make them filibuster, right? Make them talk all night. Mm-hmm. And I think here there are sort of two issues to keep in mind. First, and maybe the energy bill is a little different because I think, in fact, there weren't Democratic votes to sustain an energy bill.
Because there are a number of Democrats from states that were energy producers who would have voted with the Republicans.
So a coal-producing state like West Virginia, even Senator Rockefeller, who is quite a loyal partisan Democrat on most issues, made it pretty clearly known that he wasn't going to vote in lockstep with Democrats on energy reform. But take up a different bill, say any of these, right, the unemployment benefits bills, perhaps another stimulus bill, any issue where there might be a unified Democratic Party, why don't they sort of put the Republicans' feet to the fire and make them talk all night? Here you sort of have to get into the nitty-gritty here of how the Senate works. And what would essentially happen in the middle of the night, say 2 or 3 a.m., a Republican senator might be holding the floor to try to block the Democrats from proceeding on another major issue. And looking around the chamber, he might say, gee, every senator's around their cots. They're not in the chamber. I'm going to ask for a quorum call. I'm going to make a request of the clerk to call the roll of the senators. If the Senate fails to get a quorum of 51 senators present, then the bill falls off the floor. And, of course, that harms the Democrats, not the Republicans. And you could imagine that at 3 in the morning, most Democrats themselves don't want to show up on the floor of the Senate to simply say, yes, I'm here to attend a quorum call. And so the tactics of a filibuster in many ways make it easier on the minority party than advantage the majority party. And think about it. If it were an issue like health care or an issue where the public is divided, right, the whole point of making minority party talk all night is that we think eventually they would fold, right? That public opinion would so turn on them that they would give up this battle. But in today's Congress, the Republicans aren't giving up, right? They fully believe in the policy positions that they're taking. And something on health care where the public is divided, it's not really clear that the minority would take the blame. Right?
But doesn't this lead to tit-for-tat politics? So now the Republicans take over the Senate, and the Democrats say, okay, well, you did it. Now it's our turn to do it. And then the Republicans are the minority, and they say, well, you did it during the last Congress, and so we're going to do it.
Mm-hmm. And that has been going on at least since easily from the early 1990s with the advent of the Clinton administration, is what we could think of as sort of a procedural arms race. Right? And it's not just filibusters, it's not just cloture votes, it's all sorts of elements of the Senate are being drawn into this arms race. Right, both parties are looking for new ways to exploit the rules to make life hard for
the Republicans invoked the so-called nuclear option when they were in control, and there have been a number of proposals on the table to reform the filibuster. Do you think we're going to see an end to it ever?
Ever is a long time, and periodically over the course of the Senate's 200 plus years, there have been moments of reform. Certain things have to be in place to really reform the filibuster, and we can think of really certainly the event that created the cloture rule in the first place in 1917 under sort of the force of Woodrow Wilson and the threat of World War I, that the Senate, a small minority, was blocking the Senate from passing a bill that Wilson deemed a war measure that was essential to the security of the United States. And that's what it took to get a small group, 11 senators, to back down in order to pass the first major cloture rule in the Senate. It's this sort of confluence. You need that perfect storm, right, where the filibuster gets tied up with an issue, where there's broad majority support, and the president is willing to put the full force of that bully pulpit on behalf of his position, on behalf of cloture reform. But those moments really seem to be few and far between.
We have just 30 seconds left. Are there any other national parliaments or congresses that have similar rules that allow unlimited debate?
We'd have to reach back to the 19th century. I think Australia, we could reach back to, I think, certain elements of the Roman Senate. There are a handful of states that have quasi-filibuster rules, but nothing as stark and as real as we see in the Senate today.
Thank you so much for talking with us. Sarah Binder is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a political science professor at George Washington University. She's been talking with us today as part of our backstory look at the filibuster. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me.